Okay, so I think there are quite a few people who are very well acquainted with the Tahoe client here, but there may be some others, those working in flares and corona stuff, who are not so familiar with it. So maybe it's a good idea to start by defining the Tahoe client and telling you about its properties. Sorry. This is a bit awkward because originally I wanted to print the view graphs, but it turns out that it's next to impossible here, so I'm going to show them like this. So this is of course the well-known internal rotation rate inside the Sun as determined by heliosismology, where red is the fastest rotating part close to the equator and blue is the slowest rotating part close to the poles. And well, for our purposes here, we can just consider it independent of depth inside the convective zone, and there is this rigid rotation below the convective zone, and there is a transition layer in between, which is called the Tahoe client. And the interesting thing about the Tahoe client is that it's extremely thin. Until about 2 or 3 years ago, there were only upper limits on the thickness of the Tahoe client. Now there are actually also statistically significant lower limits, but it's still very thin. The complete thickness of the Tahoe client is not more than about 20,000 kilometers. So,
observed is confusing.
Observed, I mean, in a very indirect way by heliosismology, of course, yeah. Before we get completely entangled into the different omegas, so here I have a summary of the notations that I will use. Omega capitals is the total angular velocity. Omega naught is the rigid internal angular velocity. Omega BCZ is essentially the differential rotation law at the surface, which I take to be the same in the whole convective zone. And then omega small is the residual rotation rate relative to the rigid rotation rate in the interior. Overbar will be time average over a solar cycle. And delta omega is the difference compared to the average at a given level, at a given radius. So what do we know from the observations, that is the heliosismic inversions? The full thickness of the Tahoe client is order of a few percents of the solar radius. It depends on how exactly you define it, because the way they do it in heliosismology is that they usually use forward modeling. They assume some kind of profile for omega in the Tahoe client. That profile has a width parameter, and then they determine that width parameter. And different people use different analytical forms for that profile, and they arrive at different widths. But if you just turn them into the same units, and it turns out the scale height of the Tahoe client, so to say, so the scale height of this delta omega quantity, for example, is order of 1% of the solar radius, which is extremely thin. It's comparable to the thickness of the chromosphere, which is just a very thin line when you see it during a solar eclipse. The position of the Tahoe client is such that it is at low latitudes, it is positioned just below the convective zone. Convective zone in the sense of heliosismology, that is just below the adiabatically stratified part of the Sun. At higher latitudes, it extends somewhat into the adiabatically stratified part. So it seems that the Tahoe client is slightly prolate. It is positioned at a bit shallower depths at higher latitudes. And it looks like it's also a little bit thicker at higher latitudes, but I think that that result is not significant yet. So this thinness of the Tahoe client constitutes a problem, because if you just take the simplest possible model and forget about turbulence and magnetic fields and anything, then if you take the solar interior, you impose as upper boundary condition the observed differential rotation at the surface or in the convective zone, then what you get with an isotropic molecular viscosity is a stationary solution where the differential rotation extends very deep into the sun, which is just a trivial consequence of the fact that in this simple case, the equation of motion reduces to a diffusion equation, which in the stationary case turns into a Laplacian. And then the radial derivative is of the same order of magnitude than the horizontal derivative. So how can we avoid this? Well, of course, one consideration is that this is a stationary solution, which is only achieved on a viscous time scale. And the viscous time scale is known to be very much longer than the age of the sun. So one might think that the whole problem is not really interesting because the sun has not reached the stationary state, and that's it. But then in 1992, Spiegel and Zahn pointed out that viscosity is not the only effect there. There is also meridional circulation, which can have several contributions, but at least one effect, the Eddington-Sweet circulation, is unavoidably there. And that is much more effective in extending the differential rotation into the radiative zone than the viscosity. Again, about Eddington-Sweet circulation, the general notion is that it is also a very long timescale process, otherwise the whole sun would be completely mixed. And that's true in a global sense, but locally, in the Tycho Klein layer, its timescale is not so long. It's definitely shorter than the solar age. So models have shown that if you take into account the Eddington-Sweet circulation, then again, you end up with a Tycho Klein that is much thicker than what is observed. So the original solution to this problem, which Spiegel and Zahn proposed, was that there is a very strongly horizontally anisotropic turbulence in the Tycho Klein. In general, what we need is clearly some mechanism to transport angular momentum that is much more effective in the horizontal direction than in the vertical direction. So anisotropic viscosity was one mechanism proposed. There were other hydrodynamical effects proposed to do this. But it has turned out that none of this can explain the observation satisfactorily for various reasons. First, the orders of magnitude involved are huge. In the case of an isotropic viscosity, you need a turbulent viscosity where the horizontal component of... The horizontal component of the Reynolds stress is two or three orders of magnitude higher than the vertical component, which has never been observed in any natural situation, or not even in laboratory, as far as I know. You think it was?
Certified flows in the ocean,
for example. Well, in the ocean, I think, as far as I know, the observed anisotropies are much lower than this.
Yeah, but the stratification is also much less.
Yeah, that's a possibility. Okay, but that's just one point. The other point is, which is, I think, more to the point, which was pointed out by, I think, Goh and McIntyre, that even if this works, it would not ensure a rigid rotation, because these effects, which are actually known from meteorology, where you have two-dimensional motions, tend to produce a homogeneous distribution of the potential vorticity, and not of angular momentum or of angular velocity. And finally, in order to have the turbulence, you need some instability there to produce the turbulence. And actually, the stability analysis, which were done by Charbonneau and Peter Gilman and several people from the Boulder group, show that in the purely hydrodynamical case, in the strongly subadiabatic part of the Tycho Klein, which is most of it, there is no instability.
Why do you have to have instability? Why can't you just have convective overshoot beam?
Well, convective overshoot is a possible source. Actually, we don't really know the extent of convective overshoot. But this part of the Tycho Klein, I mean most of the Tycho Klein, and at low latitudes all of the Tycho Klein, is very strongly subadiabatic. Which I'm not saying it's impossible to have convective overshoot there, because there are some models which have an extensive convective overshoot in a strongly subadiabatic stratifications. But, well, it's open.
That's a bit too much to call overshoot. If you just count waves, internal waves as well as...
Okay, internal waves, yeah. I mean, gravity waves have also been proposed. And I think about 5 years ago, they were quite popular as an explanation for for the tintile climb, but then it turned out that they have the same problem as the anisotropic viscosity, that the equilibrium state that they produce is not one of constant angular velocity. So actually they produce shear instead of reducing shear. So
those stability calculations are they assume a state where the instability is driven by variations in latitude rather than they don't look at whether the radial.
I think that some of them are three-dimensional, so they include both.
The original ones by Watson, which were in 1966, something like that, were on latitude.
Right. But I think this one by Charbonneau et al. Includes both. They use the full observed profile, right?
No,
isn't it so?
It's just 2D.
And then there is one by Gilman et al. Where it's a shallow layer, which is not.
Like Gilman, Charbonneau.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's 2D. Okay.
The radial barriers. That's the massive thing.
Yeah, that's right. But usually what they assume is that the instability is driven by the 2D because in the radial direction the stratification is acts stabilizing. Or that's what one would expect. But okay, so I'm not saying that any of these arguments is really absolutely compelling and has no leeway out, but it looks like nowadays most of the people think that magnetic fields are crucial here, which is actually natural because we know that the magnetic fields are there. So you can't really forget them. The question is, what kind of magnetic field can we have in the Tahoe line? There are two possibilities, obviously. It is generally believed that there is some weak internal primordial remnant field in the radiative interior because that is also needed to explain the lack of radial differential rotation in the deeper layers. I think it was first pointed out by Hank Sprout quite a few years ago, 10 or 20 years ago, that the breaking due to the solar wind should produce a significant radial differential rotation, which is not there. And practically the only way, and at any rate the most plausible way to explain this, is to assume a weak primordial internal field. And then there is also the dynamo field, which is oscillatory. The question is which one is dominating in the Tahoe line, and that basically depends on the value of the turbulent diffusivity in the Tahoe line, because if you have an oscillatory field like the dynamo field, and the depth of penetration of that field into a highly conductive medium depends on the diffusivity according to the well-known skin depth formula. And if you put in the numbers here, then what you find is that the critical value of the turbulent diffusivity from this point of view is about 10 to the 8th or 10 to the 9th CGS. So if the diffusivity is higher than this, then the dynamo field can penetrate the Tahoe line, and it will be the dynamo field that will determine the dynamics there on a short time scale. Whereas if the diffusivity is lower than this value, then the penetration of the dynamo field will be much less than the thickness of the Tahoe line, and then the internal field will penetrate the Tahoe line.
Christopher, we don't have turbulent diffusivity or molecule because you're talking about transitional layer. There must be some sort of a curve when turbulent convection zone goes into.
You mean it's not constant?
So you're living on changing.
Right.
H or whatever you.
Yeah, that's right.
And what do you mean by particular value?
Okay, as you will see in our models, in most of the models, we actually have a constant diffusivity or a slightly varying diffusivity. But of course, if it is varying, then you can assume that if it's just reducing in a continuous way, then as long as it is higher than this value, the dynamo field can penetrate, and once it is reduced below this value, the dynamo field won't penetrate any deeper. Obviously, it's very easy. I mean, the skin depth comes out from a solution of the diffusion equation, which you can do analytically. Well, if the diffusivity is not constant, you can do the same, but numerically. You can calculate it and then read. And actually, this is what we are doing, as you will see.
Maybe the question is also, why do you adopt such a large value of 10 to the 9?
I don't adopt any value. That was the question mark in the title in my talk.
Oh.
I mean, there are two possibilities. It's either higher or lower. Uh-huh. And actually, I think no one knows, because most of the stability analysis that we have for the Tahoe Klein are linear. Nowadays, we are beginning to have some nonlinear calculations like that of Mark and others, but it's still in a very preliminary phase. So really, nobody knows the value. We're just playing around with the value as a parameter. So in the case when the diffusivity is lower than that, then you have the internal remnant magnetic field dominating in the Tau Klein. And there are some calculations for that. The first one was done by Rüdiger and Kichatinov in 97, and then McGregor and Charbonneau in another one in 99. It turns out that if it is assumed that the internal field is closed into the radiative interior, so the field lines don't cross the boundary, then even a very weak internal field of 10 to the minus third or 10 to the minus fourth Gauss is sufficient to produce a thin Tahoe Klein, because it is wound up by the differential rotation many, many times until you get a very strong toroidal field. And the Maxwell stresses in this strong field then act to reduce the differences in angular rotation rate between pole and equator. However, as it was already pointed out by McGregor and Charbonneau, it is not a natural assumption that the field is closed into the radiative interior, because the external boundary is the convective zone, which is not a perfect conductor, far from that. And if they allow that the field lines cross the boundary, then there is a theorem called Ferraro's theorem, which is actually a trivial consequence of field line freezing, that says that in ideal MHD, in a stationary state, the angular velocity should be constant along field lines. So in that case, you'll end up with a deep penetration of differential rotation again. Now there are some newer calculations by Garot that include meridional circulation, although they have some other simplifications, such as incompressibility. And in those calculations, in some parameter range, it is possible to produce such a pattern of meridional circulation that ensures that the internal field is closed into the radiative interior. But so this is one possibility, but it's certainly not the only possibility. Because
may I ask, does the internal field exclude itself because we have solar cycle? You have to change the direction of field every 11 years. How you
well, the question is that how deep does the solar cycle go?
No, if there is no dynamo, there is always some mysterious field, then you have to explain why it changed sign every time.
But the internal field is not supposed to change sign, or I don't quite
agree. It's a dynamo field.
Oh, you put dynamo on top of it.
Yeah, that's the point. The question is, where's the boundary between the two? So the alternative is, which has not been looked into very much before, is that we have this relatively high value of the diffusivity, either as a product of some Tahoe Klein instability or just because of overshooting convection, as Alex said. And then what are the consequences of this if we have an oscillatory dynamo field penetrating? Can an oscillatory field also limit the Tahoe Klein? So that's what we looked into.
But if you do that, maybe you should test it.
Yeah. Okay, so these were just the arguments that I mentioned. Well, actually, there is one very convincing argument that we have the dynamo field in the Tahoe Klein, that all the dynamo models that we have assume that. I mean, the omega effect in all present dynamo models is assumed to occur in the Tahoe Klein, and we saw that at least at the low latitude layers where most of the solar activity occurs, the whole of the Tahoe Klein lies below the adiabatically stratified convective zone in a strongly subadiabatic part. So if the dynamo field could not penetrate the Tahoe Klein, then we would be in big trouble with the dynamo. Okay, so before the numerical calculations, we can do some estimates that can give us some guidance on how to choose the parameters. So for the estimates, we take a very simple model, a plane parallel model, where at the top boundary we impose a shear flow in one direction, which is periodic in the x direction, and the flow itself is in the y direction, say. and we impose a homogeneous magnetic field in the x direction. It's a horizontal field, which is, however, oscillating in amplitude. We measure the magnetic field components in alphanic units, and we write down the equation of motion and the induction equation for this system. They look misleadingly simple, so I spent a day or two by trying to find an analytic solution. Turns out that you cannot do that, but you can still make order of magnitude estimates on the basis of these equations. If you separate the flow, the equation of motion into a mean and a perturbation equation, then you end up with three equations. And if, from these three equations, you can solve them for the field strength or for the tau Klein depth, and you get this relation. This is an order of magnitude relation, exact to be more exact. And this gives you the field strength of the poloidal magnetic field in alphanic units as a function of the tau Klein scale height, which is h here, and of the diffusivities, that is the viscosity and the magnetic diffusivity. And if we plot this relationship, we arrive at something like this. So as a function of the diffusivity, which is still assumed to be constant, the field strength that is necessary to confine the tau Klein to a scale height of, say, 1% of the solar radius is like this. So, for example, if we take eta equal 10 to the 10th, then a field strength of a few thousand gauss should be enough. And if we vary the thickness of the tau Klein, or if we vary the magnetic Prandtl number, the turbulent magnetic Prandtl number, then we arrive at slightly different values. But still, this gives us some idea of the orders of magnitude involved. And they don't look bad, because a few kilogauss for the poloidal field seems just right. OK, so now to the numerical model for the real sum, for spherical geometry, for the real stratification, and so on. So what we solve is the full equation of in induction equation, and we solve the azimuthal component of the equation of motion in a rotating frame. Meridional circulation is either assumed to be zero, or in some models we include it, but then it's just an arbitrarily prescribed flow. So of course, the velocity is written in this form, a differential rotation and the circulation, and B is, as usual, split into toroidal and poloidal parts. This function just shows the kind of meridional circulation that we use in some models. So in some models, we use a one-cell pattern where we have an equatorward flow in the tau Klein. And in some other models, we have a two-cell pattern with a poleward flow in the tau Klein, just to play around with it a little bit. And the actual volume that we compute is the volume between this dashed line and this dotted line here. So the upper boundary of our computational volume is the bottom of the convective zone. The lower boundary is quite deep down, just to make sure that the thin tau Klein that we get is really thin, and it's not just an artifact of the boundary condition, because at the lower boundary we impose the rigid rotation.
So the circulation is an upper boundary
condition? No, the circulation is where we have circulation, which is just a few models, there we prescribe it throughout the volume. And the magnetic field is only prescribed at the upper boundary, and the upper boundary condition is such that the poloidal field is a simple oscillating dipole with a period of 22 years, which is just the simplest representation. And the toroidal field is assumed to be zero, saying that in the convective zone, the toroidal field will be lost by buoyancy, so it should be very much weaker than in the tau Klein. And the diffusivities in most of the models that we have are assumed to be constant, which is, of course, inconsistent, because if these diffusivities, the turbulence, is a consequence of an instability in the tau Klein, then it should go to zero at the bottom, or it should go to the molecular value, which is many orders of magnitude lower. Of course, numerically, it is very difficult to treat a diffusivity which is varying by so many orders of magnitude. But in some models, we do have a diffusivity that is reduced by at least one or two orders of magnitude towards the bottom.
So
So this upper boundary, you say, is supposed to be taken in the convection zone itself?
No. Yeah, the upper boundary is just the lower boundary of the convection zone of the adiabatic stratification.
And you assume there's no toroidal component of the field there?
Yeah.
I mean, you would think there might be a toroidal component.
Right. So, okay. Actually, I think there is this famous stability analysis for thin flux tubes, which shows that the instability for the M equal zero mode already starts at a slightly subadiabatic value. Is it right?
Because Antonio is gone.
Oh, yeah. So there's some beta delta lower than something. The plasma beta times the superadiabaticity must be lower than some negative number. Yeah.
I had a remark concerning the bottom boundary conditions. This is very constrained. You put everything to zero. But if you include what I write as variable diffusivity, then you can formulate easy realistic boundary conditions.
The bottom boundary, I think, it's just a perfect conductor, which if you assume that...
Perfect conductor does not mean that the pi is zero.
Right. Perfect conductor doesn't mean you can
right.
have a colloidal field which goes through, and you live long enough, anything can penetrate eventually. Those conditions are very special.
Yeah, that's right. And also the thing is that...
Sometimes our experience show that it will give you completely different solutions.
But in this case, this is the oscillatory field that falls from the outside. Yeah. And of course, you can have an addition, you can have another field. But this
well, that's right.
The so-called the penetration of the oscillatory field is perfectly okay to sort of be...
Yeah, that's right. So we don't have the permanent field inside now. We forget about that.
It's not a perfect conductor. It's a mathematical artifact. Or mathematical...
Well, but you know then, with every solution, if the diffusivity is not too high, then skin depth argument will just tell you it goes down exponentially. So a B equals zero at a finite distance is not much different.
Well, actually,
B equals zero.
Okay, yeah. At this radius of 0.4, yeah? So it shouldn't have mattered.
I think we are not very worried about the lower boundary condition for the magnetic field, but actually for omega, you are right that you will see later in the results that because here we prescribe the internal rotation rate as a fixed rate, that means that in some of the models we will get a spurious radial differential rotation because this prescribed rate is not the same as what would be spontaneously produced in our model. So in the next round, I think we'll just relax this a bit and we'll impose no differential rotation at the bottom, but we don't prescribe the value of omega.
Stress-free sounds like the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, because this
That's
allows
right.
any abrupt solution to it, because nothing from derivative, you go to your zero just jumping from the cliff, and that's not the case.
Can I ask about the self-boundary condition again? I think I'll like a Patrick and George's question. Well, why was the toroidal field zero your top boundary?
At the top?
Yeah.
Well, basically because in the convective zone, the toroidal field is very weak.
Sorry?
In the convective zone, I mean, you will see that in these solutions, in the Tahoe line, we get a field like a toroidal field of order of 10 to the 4th Gauss at least. And the field in the convective zone is much weaker than that.
So are you assuming that once you get a convection zone, there's either no toroidal field or that it's emerged in the...
It just emerges on a short time scale. That's the assumption. I mean, it may or may... Sorry?
If you have overshoots in convection, any toroidal field will just be held down.
It depends. I mean,
basically what you're
because if it's intermittent,
contains this entire toroidal field that you see in the dynamo. It's contained in your dynamo.
So, are you saying you could, maybe this is a semantic question, because he can take his upper boundary to be above wherever he thinks the toroidal field is all
size.
But you could say your upper boundary to be anywhere in the
connection. Another way to put it, that this was the assumption that sounded to be the least restrictive. Because if I don't take it to be zero, then what else shall I take it for? So that's...
You put it in the vacuum. And the vacuum particularly requires a different diffusivity or conductivity. And the sun has huge convection.
here. That's why it's not realistic again. Yes, well, that's what
I think we should all carry on.
Well, that's a question. Okay, anyway, so this is what we have at the moment. Let me show you what we get with this one.
But just for
and
the future, I think it's important to realize that there can that there's likely to be toroidal field in the convection zone. First place, the bottom of the convection is actually stable stratified, so you're not going to have the buoyancy problem on the top of note.
Yeah.
I think you can get around that semantic by redefining where the convection zone is.
That's a way to do it, but then we. I mean, we assume that the there is no dynamo in this, so we impose the oscillatory behavior, and that assumes that the alpha effect is taking place above our upper boundary. So if we go very far up, then there's no place for the alpha effect anymore. But. So anyway, okay, this is first just to show that with a given set of parameters, I think this was for unit Prandtl number and diffusivity of 10 to the 10th, if we vary the field strength, we get different thicknesses for the Tahoe line. So what we get here, of course, this is the equator and this is the pole, and it's not shown in the proper spherical geometry because then you wouldn't see anything. It's a very thin layer. So for a weaker field, you still get a rather thick Tahoe line. The penetration of the differential rotation is still quite deep. If you increase the field strength, it gets thinner and thinner, until you can reproduce the observed thickness of the Tahoe line for a few kilogauss value.
Which field strength?
The right. Poloidal, the field strength of the imposed poloidal field at the bottom.
Aren't you running equations, or you keep some parameter?
At the bottom, top boundary condition is an imposed dipole field that is oscillating, and it all depends on the amplitude of that field.
Mm-hmm. Your choice of fields,
No, actually, I can show you the Lorentz force if you're interested. It's not on the view graphs, but we made a plot of the Lorentz force, and it looks like this. Yeah, there is no Lorentz force at the bottom, at the top, but right there, it's appearing. So it makes some difference if I change the upper boundary conditions, but I don't think it's really order of magnitude, but we should look into that. Okay, so in the rest of the plots, we only show that field strength which assures the right thickness for the Tahoe line, and then we vary the other parameters. So if we still take a unit Prandtl number and we vary the diffusivity, and we always take the solution for that field strength, which just reproduces the observed thickness of the Tahoe line, then what we get is... In the left, I plot a map of omega, which is the difference of the rotation rate relative to the rigid rotation rate at the surface. So it's higher at the interior. So it's higher than the interior rate here and lower than the interior rate here. And all this is an average over one cycle. And in the right-hand plot, I plot as a function of the radial coordinate of depth below the convective zone, the degree of differential rotation over a solar cycle, averaged over a solar cycle. So this is actually the difference of the rotation rate compared of the mean rotation rate at the given radius at different latitudes. So this also gives you an idea of the dependence on latitude. And it looks like if the field strength is held fixed, then again, with different values of the diffusivity, we get different Tahoe line thicknesses. The higher viscosity is in general better to produce a rather smooth Tahoe line, and especially it's better to suppress this polar dip of deep penetration.
Does the value of the subadiabatic gradient come into the into the rotation rate at all?
Not directly, just by the overall stratification. I mean, the density, we use a solar model, the density and like. But the only thing by which the subadiabatic stratification will come in is that it sets an upper limit for the meridional circulation speed that we use in the later model.
Your value for the colloidal field is very large, isn't it, compared to what most people would?
For the colloidal field, it's a few thousand gauss. Do you think it's large?
Yeah.
Well, some people at another talk told me it's too low.
That is normal.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, a few thousand is big, isn't it, compared to 10,000?
I mean, the equipartition field is like 10,000 gauss, so.
Yeah, but that's a toroidal field. It suggests a massive toroidal field.
Well, it should be 10 to the fifth up to, depending on filling factor, of course. But.
In the beads, in the tubes?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the average perhaps is 2,000.
Yeah, could be.
But
okay, going back to, there was this plot. Actually, this all depends on the parameters.
He's got 10 pounds. He's got a few kilograms as a colloidal.
I think this was page number. How do I move this mouse, Excel?
Click okay.
Yeah, we've got to find his cursor first.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's over
on the right, okay.
Next to the there you go. Move it over to okay. Can I get your mouse?
Okay.
Okay, John.
And I think it was 4. Yeah, no, it was. So there was this plot, which shows you the field strength that I need. So if you don't like this field strength, we can assume a lower diffusivity because we don't know the value of the turbulent diffusivity anyway, and then a lower field strength will do.
I think what I don't like is the bound conditions, which
the upper?
Which would change everything.
The upper boundary conditions, you mean?
That's a massive field, absolutely huge compared to any estimates from time.
But I mean, that's what I'm saying, that you can do it with a lower field if the diffusivity is lower.
Yeah, so let's see. If you go down by a factor of 1,000, then you would need 1,000 times smaller diffusivity, or how does it work?
Yeah, but in that case, I mean, the diffusivity, if it's lower than 10 to the ninth, then the dynamo field doesn't penetrate the top line anyway. But anyway, why would you go down by a factor of 1,000? That's just 1 gauss.
So we are set. No, 10 gauss. Well, I thought you were using 10,000. So you go down by a factor of 1,000?
No, it's just about order of kilogauss. So
you use the kilogauss? Okay, so go down by a factor of 100.
But why do you want to go by a factor of 100 and don't
forget? The ratio of colloidal to toroidal field, of course, is given by the ratio of alpha to the differential rotation. And we believe that is on the order of 100 or something. Yeah.
Well, it depends. It's order of 10, I think.
On the surface, colloidal field is about the gauss.
Yeah, right.
Take it down 30% of radius. It doesn't increase.
No, actually that's not right, because at the surface it's order of a gauss. But if you compute a magnetic flux transport model like turbulent pumping, then in the deep convective zone, that is in most of the convective zone, it's order of 10 gauss already. And that's over a layer of thickness 100,000 kilometers. And if you assume that these poloidal field lines must close somewhere in a layer of thickness one order of magnitude at least less than the convective zone, then it should be still one order of magnitude more. So that gives you at least a few hundred gauss there.
So at least. It's the theta component of the field that you get in this way. It's not
yeah.
The radial component.
It's a theta component, right.
Because at the surface, what you see is the radial component.
Okay, but for a more or less dipole-like field, it should be similar.
Well, no, because in this layer, you squeeze it into a thin layer, and only the theta component goes up.
radio component still stays the same.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the theta component. Right?
Exactly. So colloidal is sort of confusing if people think colloidal in terms of what you see at the surface in terms of colloidal field, because that's the radio component and not the theta component.
So I guess the right way
they come from the surface.
You know, in coronal holes, there's about 10 to the 22 Maxwells. So I guess what we have to do is take 10 to the 22 Maxwell and squash it into your thin layer. That gives you a, if you see you
do it. Well, not necessarily, because that assumes that all the field lines come up to the surface. But actually, most of these field lines close back right in the convective zone, so you don't never see them.
Well, do we know?
Yeah, because, well, there is a model which calculates it by turbulent, taking into account turbulent pumping and turbulent diffusion and all these turbulent transport effects in the convective zone.
If divergence at B is zero, and you've got this, and over the North Pole you've got 10 to the 22 Maxwells, it would seem to me like the most optimistic assumption is that all of that flux goes down into the overshoot layer.
Yeah, that's the least optimistic. Well, I mean, depends on your point of view.
But yeah, but it seems to me like it would at least give you an upper limit on the.
It's a lower limit actually, because if some of the field lines close back in the convective zone. Then...
Well, if you want an estimate on the colloidal field strength, I think it's an upper limit. Because
well, it depends on.
Have more, that's assuming no flux closes in the convection zone, right?
Yeah. You are of course assuming that the source of the flux is really the bottom, and you seem to assume that the source of the colloidal flux is actually more at the surface.
So I'm talking about a geometry like this. When you measure some flux here, but there's a lot more flux here, and all this flux, as the field lines must close, must be present here. But of course, if you think about something like this, then
maybe
it's the opposite. But
the other way.
But then that assumes that the field should be produced near the surface. So,
isn't the question that you need to answer? You chose a particular colloidal field strength and a particular diffusivity. If you chose a different colloidal field strength, which makes these guys happy, and a different diffusivity, would you get the same answers?
Yeah. We did that. Actually, I think I was. You'll show it in a few view grids. Well, the only thing is that of course I cannot go to diffusivities lower than 10 to the 9th, because then the dynamo field doesn't penetrate deep down enough.
Oh, before you go away, you can't set up square root dependence on Prandtl number. Like you change ratio 100 times and it jumps 10 times, the log graph.
This is the formula, so yeah, I'm not sure if it's you can work that out or some.
The formula, but I see from the graph. okay.
Yeah, it's something like that. But anyway, you shouldn't take this very seriously, because this is the plane parallel model with a horizontal field. Here we have a spherical model where the field is not horizontal. So this is just gives you an idea, but it's not necessarily precisely the numerical value. Okay, so that's the next thing. We vary the magnetic Prandtl number. So this is two cases. In one case, here you can see how sensitive the field strength is that we need. If we go down by eta to 10 to the 9th, whereas we fix the diffusivity to 10 to the 10th, then we need a field as strong as 16,000 Gauss, which is really too strong. But if we turn it around, then we need a field strength which is one order of magnitude less. And this is just varying the Prandtl number between 0.1 and 10.
Maybe we can ask Hank, what is the actual Prandtl number at the base of the convection zone?
Well, because
if you draw the turbulence.
Well, this is a turbulent Prandtl number. So
yeah, but if you take the molecular one.
Oh, but it's
really
about 100. I mean, 10 to the minus 2.
10 to the minus 2.
Yeah.
That's presumably will stay.
even you include turbulent
flow. Okay, this is if you include the meridional flow, a few centimeters per second, which is close to the upper boundary allowed by the subadiabaticity. And then, of course, what you get is the if you have an equator wall circulation that makes the tachocline thicker, and if you have a poleward circulation, then it tends to make the tachocline thinner, so it is benevolent for a thin tachocline.
What does it mean, -3 kilometers per second goes from the pole and sinks to the equator?
Yeah, minus three is the poleward flow, which is assumed to be in a two-cell pattern. Now, this is just gives you an idea of the time dependence, because all the previous results were averages over a cycle. Actually, there is a quite significant time dependence in these models, which is, well, qualitatively okay, but the amplitude is too high compared to heliosseismology. It seems it's too high.
The 1.3-year oscillation?
No, we didn't find anything like that. No. So it's only the oscillation that we put in.
I don't understand what you say the amplitude is too high in heliosseismology.
Well, in heliosseismology, you see quite a lot of variation, but most of it doesn't seem to follow any pattern. But of course, we can't tell because the whole period observed is much less than a cycle. And most of it is apparently not significant. Even the 1.3 years thing is, according to some, it's not significant. So it's hard to tell, really. This shows the variation, the temporal variation of the width of the tachocline in the model. At low latitudes, it's still not so bad, but at high latitudes, it's definitely very strong. And this is the variation of the width of the tachocline as a function of the latitude. And in this range of latitudes, which is where we can make sensible comparisons to heliosseismology, it looks pretty much like what is found from heliosseismology. But I don't want to overemphasize this, because this model is still very simplified, partly for the reasons that you pointed out during the talk, and partly because, and that is one of my main worries, is while the upper boundary condition is just a dipole, it's nothing like the butterfly diagram. So that's what we are about to do now, that we change the boundary conditions, putting in some migrating field that looks more like the butterfly diagram, and see what we can get then. Because otherwise, I wouldn't trust very much these details of the results, as the whole assumption is so simplistic. So I think the main conclusion of this is that it is possible to produce a thin tachocline without a permanent internal field. I'm not saying there is no permanent internal field, but it is not absolutely necessary just to produce a thin tachocline. You can produce a thin tachocline with an oscillatory field with a period of 22 years. If you don't like the field strength of a few kilogauss, you can do that with field strength as low as a few hundred gauss. I think lower than that will not work.
So, and you put all dynamo into the tachocline, right?
All what?
Whole dynamo works only in
No. Actually, we assume that the alpha effect works above the tachocline. And therefore, we don't have the dynamo in our model. We just impose the oscillation at the upper boundary.
Wait, above tachocline, you put
B0? The toroidal, yes, but the poloidal, not. Okay, so this is not a dynamo model.
Alpha times B gives you poloidal. If B is zero,
That's right, in a sense, yeah. So I need at least some weak toroidal field there. But of course, not in all models, because there are the Babcock-Clayton type models where the alpha is non-local. So the alpha effect is produced on the basis of the toroidal field in the tachocline. But I don't want to get into the dynamo here, because there are so many different dynamo models and so on that we rather avoided that.
That's a principal question. Is it possible to pack dynamo into tachocline, or we still need...
I think it is possible. I think Axel Brandenburg did it with Günther Rüdiger a few years ago. It was packed into the tachocline,
basically. We came to the conclusion that the tachocline is too thin to really generalize the...
Yeah, the problem was, I think, that these belts were too close together, right?
Sorry?
These activity belts were too close together, yeah.
So we were therefore saying the overshoot models are not a viable model, really, for the sun. And therefore we...
Yeah.
So we should go back to the distributed dynamos rather than the Robson entire convection zone, where, of course, the joy field is pumped to the bottom as a convection zone.
But, yeah.
I had a question about, it was actually, you mentioned Günther-Rüdiger. Günther's got all of these nice analytical ways of calculating mold stresses and so forth, so you get, you know, whatever differential rotation profile you like. I mean, does this, and maybe it's just a general question for the people who actually do detailed dynamics of the convection zone. I mean, is there a basis in reality in the sense of the simulations for this stuff, or how much should we believe that?
In what he does?
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting, but the thing is, they use with Kichatinov this quasi-isotropic turbulence model, which has somewhat limited validity, and they arrive at very detailed formulae for the Reynolds stress, which is, I think, very useful because it's the best we have anyway. But on the other hand, sometimes it seems to me that in some models the use of these detailed formulae is a bit too much when from other aspects, it's still so simplified that it's really pointless to go to such detail in modeling, say, the Reynolds
stress. Aspect is too much. I mean, I think the most important contribution here is the quenching of the stress by a finite inverse Rossby number. So as the inverse Rossby number exceeds unity, and of course, even for the sun, which is a slow rotator, it is already in excess of unity because it's 5. So basically every star is considered a fast rotator, and that means that the stresses are quenched by the inverse Rossby number. And as you go up with the inverse Rossby number to very rapidly rotating stars, which are 60 times in excess of solar, the stresses go down to very small values. And so the prediction then is, of course, that the relative reference rotation decreases. That's in perfect agreement with the observations.
Yeah.
So which aspect of this is then exaggerated?
I mean, well, that's not exactly what I had in mind at this point. But for instance, there was one paper recently that I read about the lithium problem, where they used the full diffusivity tensor to calculate the diffusion of lithium from the lithium burning layer to the convective zone.
Of course, that's essential, because if Jean-Paul Zahn comes up with a diffusion tensor, I think it was basically pretty much ad hoc when they came up. It was, for example, not including the lambda effect. It was not the proper anisotropic form of a tensor. So if you come up with a tensor, it has to obey certain rules, of course.
Yeah, well, the point I wanted to make here is that even if you have the exact form of the tensor, but for the order of magnitude of the tensor, you only have a mixing length type estimate. And
yeah, but even if there's a free parameter, which is basically the alpha, it's a mixing length alpha. If you put that to 1.5, you reproduce both the sun and you reproduce the differentiation of all the other stars. Which means that
for the other stars we don't really know, but
very different values of omega.
For the other stars we have very limited information from observations, but
yeah, but for three stars already there is this information now.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm not saying it's useless or anything. It just I sometimes have the impression that you don't always need all these details.
I guess maybe another way of asking that question is the cat climb the tail or the dog?
In what problem?
Well,
in the differential rotation?
The differential rotation profile, I mean, is the tack climb just responding to it, or is it fundamental?
I think it's definitely the tail. It's responding. So, I mean, the Reynolds stresses in the convective zone are so strong that I don't think they get affected by what's going on below. I wouldn't think so.
So what you show, the tack climb can exist at some entity which is sort of stable and thin, but hardly survive all these conditions, but it's not driving machine for anything, right?
Yeah. I mean, it can be the driving machine for the dynamo, of course, because of the shear, but that's another matter. Yeah.
So I have two basic questions. One is, when you talk about putting a dynamo field on top as your top boundary condition, then fine if you use any source of dynamo, whether it's Babcock laser or misplaced dynamo. But the toroidal field will exceed the poloidal field by a factor of the dynamo, assuming you're using a point where the time dynamo.
Yeah.
So that's the first one. The second point is Pascal Garreau did this calculation, or similar calculations to these, and she found that the dynamo field could not have any effect in constraining the attack plan. Can you explain why your results are?
I don't know this work of Garreau. Well, I know her works where she uses a permanent field, but and there is an older paper where she derived the penetration depth.
The first paper is on.
Ah, yeah, I know that, but she doesn't assume turbulence. She assumes molecular diffusivities. And of course, with a molecular diffusivity, the skin depth is very, very small. So, of course, there's no penetration there. That's the difference. Okay, so that's about it.